Hello, I'm Christine Bywater. You are listening to part two of a three-part conversation in the series Normal Was Never Good Enough, Resisting the Return to What Was. On this episode, Healing Teachers in Service of Equitable Learning, we speak with three guests about the importance of healing from trauma, not only for students, but for our teachers. In the wake of the pandemic, racial unrest, and economic turmoil in the last year, what can we do to ensure educators are given time and space to heal so they can be healthy, whole, and compassionate in their work with students and families? What does it look like for schools to prioritize self-care and well-being for teachers? What might happen if we don't? Resources mentioned during the episode can be found under the Resources tab at our website, CSET.stanford.edu. This series was created in collaboration with the Center to Support Excellence in Teaching and the Policy Analysis for California Education at Stanford University's Graduate School of Education. This endeavor was made possible by Stanford's Transforming Learning Accelerator, an initiative born out of Stanford's long-range vision and the Graduate School of Education. I want to first start by acknowledging that I'm broadcasting to you all from my home in Pacifica, which sits on the unceded territory of the Romatush Ohlone, who are the past, present, and future caretakers of this land. We are guests here and recognize that I benefit from living and working on their ancestral homeland. It is a privilege to call this my home, and I wish to pay my respects by acknowledging the ancestors, elders, and relatives of the Romatush community and by affirming their sovereign rights as First Peoples. Additionally, the Center to Support Excellence in Teaching, CSET, is committed to engaging in meaningful conversations such as this one around timely topics. And this effort is indebted to the groundwork laid by Nicole Luciani-Elliott and Dr. Michael Hines, who developed the structure and format of which we are using for this series. Their podcast, Teaching to Meet the Moment, is available to stream on our CSET website.
Thanks, Christine. I'm Janet Carlson, the co-host of this series. I'm the faculty director at the Center to Support Excellence in Teaching. I'm broadcasting from my home on the campus of Stanford University, and I wish to add a recognition that Stanford sits on the ancestral lands of the Muwekma Ohlone tribe. This land is of great importance to the Ohlone people and has been since time immemorial. Consistent with the values driving today's conversation to include building community and centering diversity, we also have a responsibility to acknowledge, honor, and make visible the university's relationship to Native peoples. In today's conversation, we've invited three guests who will offer their expertise about the work that needs to be done to support the healing of teachers. As school districts make plans for safely reopening their schools in the fall and helping students cope with their trauma, it is urgent that school and district leaders recognize and make space for teachers to process and heal from their own feelings of loss and grief. Nearly every teacher we work with puts their own emotional needs aside in order to address the emotional needs of their students when tragedy inevitably occurs in our schools. After 15 months of pandemic-shaped schooling, everyone associated with K-12 education is hoping for a restorative restart to school next fall. But we all know that hope is not a plan. Last week, we discussed the Reimagine and Rebuild brief and how we might change schooling to invest in relationships and deepen community partnerships to prioritize racial, linguistic, and cultural relevance and rigor so that students, their families, and educators feel safe, known, and supported. Today, we're going to zero in on teacher well-being as part of that important equation. One of the key reasons we need to take care of teachers is because experienced teachers contribute to the quality of the learning experience that students have. If we let teachers burn out, if we don't take care of teachers, then all that experience disappears to another career path. Looking at this research, as I mentioned, that was conducted pre-pandemic and is actually a synthesis of 30 research studies, we find plenty of evidence that teaching experience is positively associated with student achievement gains, that as teachers gain experience, their students not only learn more, but they're also more likely to do better on other measures of success. Teachers' effectiveness increases when they teach in a collegial working environment and when they accumulate experience working at the same grade level, in the same subject area, or in the same district. And that if a school has a critical mass of these experienced teachers, it supports greater student learning for the school as a whole. In addition, if we think about the power of a teacher, the impact is far beyond the trivial measure of its student achievement scores. When students have highly effective teachers, we see that their rate of graduation from high school goes up, the likelihood of going to college increases, the percentage of students who are employed goes up, and these students are likely to earn higher wages. If those few pieces of data don't convince you that teachers matter and we need to take care of them, then I believe our conversation with our guest today will do just that. The statistics show the relationship between effective teaching, teaching experience, and improved experiences for students are the result of having whole human beings showing up at school every day committed to their students. If we care about the quality of teaching and the learners' experiences, then we need to center the well-being of teachers. Today, we're going to honor individual teachers and their well-being, but we can't do that if we don't put teacher well-being in the space of a systemic issue. It's not on the individual teacher. This is a system-wide issue that needs to be addressed as such.
So I taught social studies in Brooklyn, mostly to 11th and 12th graders. But I remember, and I'm sure any teacher will tell you this, that so much of the job is outside of your contracted teaching hours, right? You are constantly thinking about your students, reflecting on interactions, responding to something they needed. Like, that part stretches far beyond the content knowledge of history. And it was deeply about empathy. And that work, at how I as a human was responding and processing to them as humans, that deep empathy work is some of the most rewarding, but also the most exhausting. So I'm so grateful for our guests today who are helping us bring this discussion to our audience about the importance and need for recognition of teacher well-being. So today we are honored to be joined by three guests, and I have the privilege of introducing Antero Garcia. Antero is an assistant professor in the Graduate School of Education at Stanford University. He studies how technology and gaming shape youth learning, literacy practices, and civic identities. Prior to completing his PhD, Antero was an English teacher at a public high school in South Central Los Angeles. His recent books include Everyday Advocacy, Teachers Who Change the Literacy Narrative, Good Reception, Teens, Teachers, and Mobile Media in a Los Angeles High School, and Pose, Wobble, Flow, a Culturally Proactive Approach to Literacy Instruction. Antero received his PhD in the Urban Schooling Division of the Graduate School of Education and Information Studies at the University of California, Los Angeles. Welcome, Antero.
Christine, that was a mouthful, so thanks for that introduction.
It's great to have you. Our second guest is Oriana Eris. Oriana Eris is a school mental health training specialist at CARS who approaches healing the wounds of trauma and oppression as core elements of social justice. She has worked with young people across life course from elementary school to college and has served as teacher leader, school counselor, classroom educator, and program director. She is committed to generating equity within school structures and policies by focusing on evidence-based mental health techniques and institutional design. Her work to forge a more just world is motivated by and dedicated to Amilca Isabel Mutan Fuentes. It's great to have you here, Oriana.
Thank you so much. It's an honor to be a part of this conversation.
And I'm pleased to introduce our third guest, Janelle Bentz, who is a ninth grade English facilitator in her 21st year of teaching in the state of Texas. Mrs. Bentz is an active teacher leader for the National Writing Project. She's served on the board of directors for that project for 3 years as well. She does presentations both nationally and internationally at places such as AERA, Deeper Learning, the National Writing Project, the National Council for Teachers of English, and the National Tech Annual Conference. In 2018, Janelle received the Outstanding Teaching of Humanities Award by Humanities Texas. Her passions are teaching writing, civic engagement, and amplifying learner voice. She includes mindful practices from teaching yoga to promote sustainable teaching and learning, and she believes in constantly feeding the maker within us all as one strategy to maintain a healthy and purposeful life. Welcome, Janelle.
Thank you so much. I'm happy to be here.
I want to start with a question I'll focus toward you, Antero, but of course I welcome Ariana and Janelle to join in as well. There's been a great focus on the impact of the pandemic and the change in schooling on students, but we hear a lot less on the impact it's had on teachers. From your perspective, Antero, how has this past year, with the increased attention to racial justice, the immense loss of life from the pandemic, and the economic stress that so many families are suffering from, impacted teachers?
Yeah, thanks, Janet. And thanks for hosting this series of conversations. I think the ways that I've been thinking about what teachers have faced over the past 15 ongoing number of months, for however long this is going to continue, has been not only that their emotional needs have not been considered, but I think the brunt of the demands of what's been happening in schools has been felt on top of them. It's kind of a double load of, I think, pain and trauma that teachers are experiencing, double if not triple, right? There's the personal experiences. I think, I imagine everybody who's listening or watching this has been hit personally by the global pandemic, as well as by the context of state-sanctioned violence against Black people in this country. I think that these are traumas that we've all collectively witnessed, as well as probably experienced. I think of family members who've recovered from COVID in my own family, right? So there's the very local and personal that takes a toll on all of us. At the same time, teachers are also taking the burden of thinking about how do we address the needs of students, right? If we have this emphasis on where kids are, that also means that teachers are seeking probably to engage in sharing and helping unpack the kind of trauma that we're going to be experiencing for a long, long time. And then lastly, all of the logistics of moving quickly online and then hybrid and then in person and the kind of hopscotch across different kinds of contexts and platforms has further professionalized the ways that we view teachers in terms of kind of adding on software and platforms that might act as alternatives to and curriculum disseminators rather than building on the teacher expertise of those that are working with kids, as well as, you know, just placing teachers in these kinds of gymnastics of how do we get to do the work we're doing. So I think all of these just kind of layer on top of one another. And at some point, you know, how much more are we asking of teachers in a way that is clearly not equitable? But I would be curious from Ariana and Janelle, you know, the ways that this has shaped your own experiences personally.
I definitely agree with what you're sharing, Antero. I think that teachers have been impacted in just about every way. So much of our work as educators is connected to our ability to support and serve our students. And when that's compromised, our own feelings of efficacy and our own feelings of self-worth, and you know, the questions that weigh over us regarding like whether we're doing the right thing. So I think just like on a deep emotional level, it has been so hard to support our young people in holding the weight of the world, holding whatever's happening in their families, and then feeling really limited by what you have the capacity, the tools and resources, the support to do. And I think there's few other professions where we're, in addition to doing our job, we're also tasked with solving social issues and without being witnessed. And then there's a lot of like villainizing of teachers and a lack of understanding around what teachers are holding and what they need that I think has been really painful for a lot of educators.
I think that as well, in addition to all of that, I think that regardless of the efforts and the quick responses by districts and local campuses, there's always that feeling, since it's different, and there's also fear and, you know, are we making these changes in a smooth transition? How well are we serving our kids? That we know that it is so different and that it is so foreign, this type of practice, to what we're used to, that we're constantly feeling that we are not good enough, that we are not doing everything we can do. And so we continue to try to do more and more and more and serve and serve and serve. And a lot of times, and I know we'll get into that, it's very difficult to say, okay, I need to take a few steps back. I need to take this hour. I need to take this night or this weekend because I can't serve right now. That's very foreign to an educator, or at least an effective educator, to adopt that mindset. But I think we're learning what true vulnerability is, and maybe that's sort of helping us as well to prepare ourselves for the restart.
Oriana, you said something that I thought I'd like to dig into more about this lack of witness, right? This lack of witnessing. And I think that was to what Antero and Janelle also shared too about a teacher's self-worth and what it means to feel valued. And when that lack of witnessing isn't happening, right? What does that mean for the teacher who's constantly hearing that they're not good enough, or they have these internal thoughts, right? On top of processing life as a human. So I'd like to know, you know, in your work, how do you think about that sort of lack of witnessing? Where have you seen that? And what sort of things would you say supported or harmed teacher well-being, either from a leadership perspective or within a school community?
Yes, thank you. So being a teacher, working in schools, depending on the community that you're working in, the school community, can feel incredibly isolating. And unless it is really intentionally built into the structure of meeting and in building community, then in my experience, I've felt incredibly isolated and, you know, working tirelessly in my own classroom or in my office as a school counselor or after school program coordinator. And so I have been able to, in the last 20 years, witness the full spectrum, really feel and experience the full spectrum of what wellness could look like, how it could be supported. And I'd like to just maybe reference the public health model, the ecological model of health, and thinking about wellness. And I think in the places where wellness has felt strongest and most central, it's been in institutions or communities that really viewed wellness in not just individual responsibility, really that's the kind of lightest touch, but that we're really looking at the policies that support wellness, that support a slower pacing, that support staffing that is adequate so that teachers really have the space and the protection to do the work that it is that they need to do. The environments I've been in where wellness has been most compromised, teachers are spread incredibly thin and work wearing like just many hats all at once, and really did not have the space, the time, the support, and the resource to focus on what it meant to be a strong, effective, attuned teacher. Additionally, wellness has thrived in communities where it has been a school-wide and district-wide goal. So in Oakland, California, there is the community schools manager position that really works to build in partnerships so that, you know, not one individual teacher is working on building those partnerships on their own, or the principal isn't working on doing that on their own. And there's also a wellness representative at each school that gets paid a stipend and that works within a community of other wellness representatives to build in practices and really is like gathering the resources necessary to center wellness.
Janelle, I'm curious how what Oriana is saying lands with your experience being in Texas, a completely different state, but also your experience with your teaching and in your district.
I have to say that there are a few things that I believe have been really attended to that have been super, super helpful. First of all, it's that understanding of by my district that we need to sort of build our relationships, not only with our learners, not only with our families, but also collegially with our colleagues. So last February, before it all hit, but I think it kind of set the tone, there was a district-wide professional development where everybody in the district was sort of invited to share their passion or something they were interested in, something, you know, where they felt creative, some sort of outlet, and sort of lead workshops on those. And so everyone could choose their own session. And it was great because we got to understand and know more people across the district, what they're interested in, what they do, how they spend their time to sort of fill their own cups. I was also able to lead a couple of yoga sessions, which were very helpful. I think people got a taste of what, you know, that mindful practice might look like for sustainable teaching. And I love every time I can do that. So that's one of the first really nice responses in terms of helping our well-being, not only as individual teachers, but also as a system of a group of teachers who will be working together and supporting each other. And then also on my own district and my own school, my own campus, every Friday we have, they're called Flex Fridays. And they're great because it's a flexible schedule for the kids. We can set up sessions for our learners who may need a little bit more help, who may need to like make up missing work. But then more importantly, it's also another chance for the facilitators to create sessions that may share a hobby or an interest or something that they might have heard of from the learners, like, oh yeah, no, I'm really interested in that. Okay, well, let's explore that. And then again, I love being able to help with yoga. So I do a couple of sessions of those with my kids. It's very well attended. And just to see the expression on their face, I know that that is in service to the kids, but it is also sort of filling our own cups when we can see those changes and we know that we are in this school, right? New Tech High at Coppell, we've created and set aside this day because we know that we need it. We know that the learners need it and that we know that as educators, we need it, that we have more to share than, yes, certainly our content expertise and our pedagogy. But there's also something that we can share in terms of what you're interested in and what may be other hints to leading a purposeful life. And I think that that is really a major part of well-being. And it allows us to model it for our learners and also model it for our peers, our colleagues on our staff to say, no, it is important to take this time for ourselves and create. And so we're always invited to do that. And that's made a huge difference.
That's an amazing description of a district that's had wellness in the foreground. Really appreciate you sharing that because I hope that it can inspire others to realize this work is possible. Last week, when we were talking, some of the comments had to do a lot with the theme of trust. And so, Janelle, I feel like there's a lot of trust with learners and the teachers in your district. Ariana, it sounds like you've had a continuum of settings where trust might have been low and trust might have been high. And I also like the phrase that you added about policies, pacing, and protection. So since Antero's gotten to listen for a while, I'm going to throw a big umbrella question at him while Janelle and Ariana soak up the comments in the chat, because what you're saying is really resonating with folks who are listening to you. Antero, if you thought about what both Janelle and Ariana have said, particularly this policies, pacing, and protection, and this idea that trust is so important for centering relationships if we're going to have a restorative restart to school, how do you see those factors coming into play to create environments that support teacher well-being? And the other phrase I might throw in there is this creating humanizing school cultures. Like, what makes those things happen and what works against them? And Janelle and Ariana, your wheels can start spinning about how you want to add in some examples from your experience as well.
I guess to maybe start with this question kind of backwards, right? This idea of like, how do you create a space that is humanizing for all of the individuals in the space, the teachers, the students, the administrators, right? The interlopers, whoever happens to be in there, can everybody be their fullest selves? And I think one thing we should think about is like the historic model, I think, of what teachers do in terms of relationships in schools is the kind of, you know, the mantra of is a no smiling till Christmas kind of routine, right? Like do not like show a crack of your own kind of personal relationship or emotions. And even if you do, like barely do it, right? That is kind of the historic tradition of what we've seen. I suspect that that assumption of how we're supposed to act as teachers is tied to the sexist and gendered nature of the teaching profession, right? So I haven't done an empirical study of this, but I would imagine we could trace why we could imagine women as frail beings with their emotions and how we must not show those within classrooms as a maybe an origin story of some of the ways we've gotten ourselves into this and many other messes. Recognizing that, right, that this idea that teachers aren't supposed to show their emotions, it means that if I come to school and I've experienced trauma in my life, I can't be my full self, right? This is an unhealthy way for me to be. I cannot be fully be the humanizing individual who my students expect of me or that I need to feel in order to thrive unless we transform those spaces, right? I think this gets to the first part of your question, Janet, in terms of wither trust, right? I think trust needs to come on a lot of parts, right? It takes a whole lot of vulnerability for teachers to trust that if they put themselves out there and say, I'm hurting right now, or I need support, or I'm grieving for these reasons, that vulnerability won't be used as some kind of trap against them by administration, by their students, by their peers, that sense of feeling vulnerable would be interpreted as something of a weakness, right? This is, I think, largely something that we have not talked about in teacher education programs and professional development, and we have not created cultures in schools. And I think, Janelle, you're pointing to a possible alternative of the ways that we could be working towards vulnerability, right? I also want to recognize that this vulnerability isn't equally felt by all participants and all teachers, right? So we have a large, diverse set of multiply marginalized forms of teachers in our schools. And so, you know, the traumas around the loss of someone like George Floyd and the continuing witnessing of his murderer's trial over the past few months, right, was probably experienced and felt differently by different teachers, particularly our Black teachers in our schools right now. And so I want to recognize like that what trust looks like is going to feel different and is going to be different. And it's, I can imagine that in Coppell, Texas, this looks and feels differently than it does in the Silicon Valley, right? Around here, there's just very different kinds of concerns. And so maybe I'll start there. I just want to add one other piece to this because I know I've been rambling. And that is this recognition that part of this trust and part of the ways that we layer on these identities, I think all three of us, Oriana, Janelle, and I are all caregivers of children to one degree or another, or not even one degree or another, of children, period. And that is also an additional form of, I think, the kinds of identities we carry into our classroom. So it's not just how are we caring for someone else's children, right? To think about the you know, the words as often are invoked in a teacher education program, but also the caregiving of our own children. And so if I'm experiencing loss or trauma as a result of the students I'm caring for during the day, how do I come home and revert back into caregiving mode, right? And I set aside this other persona, this other trauma that might be going on in school, right? There's this kind of dual-sided nature, which never allows us to be fully ourselves as a result of the ways we've set ourselves up here.
Well, I just want to echo that our identities play such a critical role in our wellness, you know, within our school settings and without and beyond. And I think it's incredibly important that leadership acknowledges identity and the heavy toll that, you know, all that is happening in our world and our country has on Black and Brown people. And then to show up and to, you know, present in a certain way and to oftentimes hold some of the hardest conversations with young people and families as well, because of our identity and maybe because of how we're able to possibly connect in deeper ways with families is a lot to always expect staff to hold additionally. And so I think being mindful of that is really important when we're thinking about wellness as leaders. And in addition to that, when thinking about humanizing school spaces, I think just asking the question is incredibly powerful. How can this conversation be a more humanizing conversation? Or how can this policy or this this protocol be more humanizing. And then that trickles into the classroom and it trickles into the way teachers begin to look at the way they have lesson, they develop lesson plans if they're not already. And so I think it's really important that a culture of humanizing is valued, is talked about, and that there's always this question we're referring every decision and conversation and structure to, like, is it and how can it become more? How can we center and value relationship and not in a tokenizing way and not in a way that possibly like not as leverage. Oftentimes I see relationships used as leverage, but more in a, how can we deepen connection so that people feel seen, heard, witnessed, and held, I think is incredibly important. And also slowing down, I just want to return to the pace, like the pacing in education is so incredibly fast. And oftentimes, as was shared at the beginning of the hour, teachers are expected to do so much work outside of the classroom and outside of the school day. And so as leaders, slowing down the pace, and not making too many decisions within a school year or a semester or all at once is, I think, really important and something to be mindful of as well.
Yeah, I cannot echo that enough, the pacing, especially when we come to those crucial and very difficult conversations or topics that especially young learners are not accustomed to having or discussing or even contemplating. And then it's there facing them amongst everything else, the pandemic and loss and things like that. I will say that it does take time to be able to have everyone sort of be vulnerable, and that it's a choice sometimes, right? Like that another choice that educators have been asked to make, because we all know the demands of the curriculum, the demands of testing and things like that. But then it's sort of like, well, you can either hit all of these check, did that, or you can really just slow down and see the big picture and understand, well, I need to build these relationships first. I need to let them know that it's okay to be vulnerable. And although it may seem like you will not be able to check those points immediately, like someone, you know, else in the building or someone across the campus, that in that investment, you know, may not seem like anything at first, but you're not just checking off. You're really having deeper understanding, deeper learning, and relationships where kids feel like, you know, they can ask those questions and they can wrestle with difficult things, that they are willing to do more difficult things because they understand, because, you know, the educators are also able to be vulnerable, that nothing's easy and that they're willing to struggle with them. And at my school, we take the entire first week, and we call it the first week project, and we don't do anything like academic yet. And I know a lot of people do that, get to know each other or whatever, but it really is a relationship building time for us. You know, games, yes, but also just to get to know the campus and the campus culture. And I think that's important.
You know, you make me wonder what would the first week project look like for teachers right at the beginning of the year, right? Or the PD model. I guess there's a tension for me, yeah, of worrying that the wrong person would hear this and think about the transactional nature of, okay, if I create a culture of vulnerability, my teachers will be more productive and my students will therefore have better academic results, right? So I don't want this to be reduced down to the kind of capitalist driven nature of how schools operate, right? I think if we're trying to break out of that mold, right, the idea of taking a step back, giving ourselves space, Oriane, I think you frame this as centering our values and deepening our connections, right? I think that's really well said in terms of, like, this isn't about, you know, better test scores. It's about better schooling experiences and modeling what the possibilities of social life for kids could be and should be, as well as a fulfilling career, hopefully, for the teachers in these systems, in my opinion.
And I want to underscore, Janelle is from Texas. I'm not sure there is a more checklist-driven state than Texas. And so the fact that you work somewhere that at least you, but from what you're describing, your school and maybe your district are willing to reorder what's important, that should really inspire a lot of people.
I mean, I do think that it is risk-taking. I think that Ontario too, when you asked about what would that first week project look like for teachers, I think that it is that we talk about for our school, like really understanding, let's get back to, you know, not, you know, scope and sequence, but let's look at what we value, what we want our kids to walk away with. And those are like our learning outcomes, those skills of like, can they collaborate? Can they problem solve? Can they really choose the best way to articulate their message and reach a specific, you know, like those are the things that like we've been talking about, like we really need to return back to that and really get to know it because that's our why. But then that's also coupled with, you know, what other, I mean, I hate to like minimize and say fun things, but when you play and you're like, you know, just last week we had a talent show and we had, you know, we have facilitators that also participate in the talent show. You know, it's like when you play alongside with your peers, it opens up the opportunity to say, oh man, what if we did this? Okay, what if we did this? And so we kind of had that notion of play, and just in our staff meeting while we were getting excited for this, oh, we'll have this, and then we have our talent show. We started thinking about like, oh, this is great. This is like breaking boundaries. And then we started like, well, what if we had this whole like, you know, idea of boundaries across grade levels and across, you know, content area? Like, what would a project on boundaries look like in algebra? It just, you could see it. You could see those ideas flowing. You could see that excitement happening. And, you know, we get to the standards because that's just who we are. We know about the standards, but it's that playing part opened up our imagination and our creativity. And that's really, really important. So,
Oriana, why don't you expand a little bit on that? You're putting some great things in chat. You've added some resources. Say a little bit more about what's on your mind.
Well, I think these are incredibly heavy times, and we're working with young people that when we allow them to be young people are filled at their core with so much joy and interest in life and in inquiry. And I think that we make things a lot more difficult and complicated than they need to be. And so centering joy and starting with passion or creating experience so that young people can explore passion and connect with it, like just create such a different culture within a school setting, within a classroom and within the hallways and the playground. And so I think that's incredibly important, especially right now where we're dealing with so much trauma and crisis on a societal level. Educator I worked with once said that our duty was really to protect their essence and to create an environment where young people didn't have to wear masks and didn't have to front or posture as someone they weren't. And when you think about your work in that way, I think fun becomes central. Yeah, I think the other thing that I was thinking about is when we connect with our purpose as a school and we're building as educators our innate intrinsic motivation, that work becomes so much more vibrant and there's so much more room to be creative and to think about learning and building community and relating with one another in different ways. Like it humanizing is so basic in many regards, and we make it more complicated. And so when we connect to our own joy, and when we, I think at one point I said that like it's really important to think about policy, and I think policy is incredibly important. I'm not going to backtrack on that, but that we do also as individuals need to center our own joy and our own wellness and think about how to protect our wellness and our our comrades' wellness as well. And so, yeah.
I agree with you that humanizing is basic. And yet if that was basic and treated as a fundamental, we wouldn't need to have this conversation today. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the kind of sad irony of where we are in schooling.
I think that that basic nature, right? I think, you know, if this come to me, if joy is about, and if schools are supposed to be joyful spaces, that joy is probably about freedom dreaming, right? If we want to use the words of Robin G. Kelly, I think this feels like such a fundamental connection. And so, Ariane, I agree with you. Like, it's not complicated. I totally appreciate your sentiment. This is not complicated what we're asking for in terms of the demands. It's complicated in terms of the ways it doesn't quite create, you know, a nice, easy balance sheet where the numbers go up in terms of someone along the line is going to have to translate these kinds of conversations into policy that makes someone's test scores go up in order for people to act on this in a widespread vision, if we're going back to the way things were 15 months ago, right? And so much of, if we remember, right, when we were going under shelter in place back in March, so many of us were fired up with that we're not going back to normal, right? But along with CDC guidelines, right, I think all of those whims of imagining anew have kind of been thrown out the window as we're so desperate to get back to some kind of sense of normalcy. And what we forget is that normalcy has been rooted in white supremacy and oppression and someone else's definitions of social emotional learning for young people. And so, you know, I think this idea of joy, this idea of humanizing, I will not probably be the first person to have thought this today, but I would invoke the words of Audre Lorde, who talks about radical self-care as an act of political warfare, right? And I think that this is some place for us to playfully reimagine, but indignantly demand something better for teachers and for students if we're serious about where we're going to be moving collectively.
Yeah, so I want to take that, what you all three have said, and ask a personal question to all three of you, if that's okay. But, you know, as we're talking about the centering essence and joy in Ontario, you know, what you're saying about sort of radical self-care, while we wait for schools and the institutions to sort of get where we're imagining and where they should be, how do you sustain yourself, right? And what do you do? What are some things that you do so that you can continue doing this work for you and your students? Janelle, do you want to start?
Sure. I do play. And I think that I'm probably one of those, you know, during the pandemic and quarantine, I probably have tried everything. But yes, roller skating. Yes. Sourdough baking. Did that. Went back to my guitar. Did that. you know, reading all the books. Yes, did all that. And I know that sounds funny, but there's a reason why people do that. There's a reason why people feel that need to explore. And there's a reason why people feel like, okay, well, if that's going to happen in this space, I'm going to go ahead and try something new. I'm going to take risks and I'm going to document it. There's something very human about that. And I think that that's what we were all looking for during quarantine. And now to bring that, you know, I'm very open, you know, with my kids in terms of, oh, I did this and I did this. And, you know, being able to talk to that about that with my learners, like, oh yeah, I'd like to go to the skate park. I'll see you there. Maybe I won't, maybe I will. I don't know. But that's, you know, it sets that, it sets the tone of that is one element of being human, that we, a common thread that we can talk about, that we can relate to. We had a recent film activity, and that's actually one of the themes that they talked about of, you know, how 2020 changed their world was people did dabble, people did explore, they tried new things instead of like, okay, here's school, you know, go to school, go home, play video games or whatever. You know, they gardened, they spent more time together, they learned how to do calligraphy. And they wanted to also report and document that because it was cool to see your progress. And they could see the beauty in that. So I think that making, creating, challenging oneself, seeing the progress, or not even seeing progress, but just realizing that you're putting yourself out there to take those risks, that for me is very sustaining. Also, you know, mindful practices like meditation, yoga, and teaching other people yoga, when I'm able to teach my yogis and my yoginis, and then on top of that, I hear that they're educators, man, that is awesome to me, because I know somewhat of what they need, and it fills me up to be able to do that for them.
I will say, I think conversation, being in conversation with teachers and those who humble me, and the being able to kind of do whatever I want in this, I'm humbled to get to talk with teachers who have much more strenuous demands on their time. But this is a space of rejuvenation for me, and I'm grateful for it. I've been in conversation with English teachers through the National Council of Teachers of English every Tuesday for the better part of over a year at this point. We'll have our 50th NCTE gathering next Tuesday. There's just been a space for teachers to check in as a result of the pandemic. I think, like Janelle, that this past year has been a space for trying to step away from being a workaholic to some extent. I have two not quite 2-year-old twin daughters who are monsters. And so, you know, we go to the duck pond. There's this duck pond by our house that really only has 2 ducks. It's the most disappointing duck pond ever, except for when those 2 ducks swim near my girls, they lose their mind. And I think that is such a great moment to be a part of, among other parts too. But, you know, I think making sure to find space for time, for play, we play a couple of board games with a friend in Atlanta and set up a whole bunch of computer Zoom screens in order for us to see the board. I think there's a whole bunch of practices they've been just trying to do to, you know, have some semblance of community. I won't say normality, but a sense of community and family with those of us that we're able to right now.
I want to echo what you both have said, definitely, and connecting it back to the pace, like slowing down the pace in our own lives, or in my own life, has been really helpful and healing to me. Being a part of conversations like this feel really fueling, making sure that the connections I have with my community feel meaningful, and that we can, you know, rather than how are you, how is your heart? Is a question we've begun asking each other, and kind of dropping below surface. I think something else that has been really helpful for me in terms of self-care is exploring boundaries. I have a tremendous way to go in regards to understanding my own boundaries and being attuned to what I need. But just having that conversation in my head and exploring my motivation for saying yes and for saying no to certain things has been really important to me. And also, the food that I'm eating and thinking about plant medicine and different herbs and how to get a full healthy range of the rainbow into my diet. It's been fun and playful as well to think about that.
Can I add one thing to the chat? See, Glenn, you did a really nice summary of ways that schools can be successful in caring for each other. And so one of these items says takes care of each other, that a community takes care of each other. And I don't disagree with that. I think that's really important. What I would add is, I think we might have some misconceptions as a teacher and teacher educator community around what taking care means and looks like. And I think I will say broadly, I think that this has been whitewashed in a way where oftentimes the words mindfulness get used in ways that might not be particularly mindful to the needs of individuals or communities. And so we might be enacting what we think is care for somebody else in a way that it might actually be doing harm or causing micro or not so micro aggressions. And so I think this is, you know, a part of a collective inquiry, and part of that vulnerability is to find out, am I caring for you in the way that is reciprocal, that feels that you are receiving that care in the way you want to be cared for? So it just feels like a part of that process. I just wanted to, it's not a critique, Glenn, of what you're saying as much as just an elaboration on it.
Well, and Antero, you actually took us right into the space I wanted to go. I wanted to see if there's a final nugget of wisdom each of you would like to offer. I'm going to count that as Antero's nugget, so I can turn it over to Ariana or Janelle. What's one last thing you'd either like to add, underscore, make sure people leave hearing in your own voices?
Maybe invest in yourself and give yourself that time and space to slow down, and permission to slow down, to uncover what does bring you joy so you know it, to uncover what gives you that sense of purpose so you know it, to the point where you can articulate it and love it and say it and mean it and model it for the others around you. And by giving that permission to yourself and taking that time before anything academic happens, hopefully you're giving other people that permission. And that's why it's going to be important to do that, because once everyone has that permission and they are in touch with what gives them purpose, hopefully that can be shared. And then that trust and that taking care of one another can be authentic, because everyone is more in touch with that. And that to me is, that's restorative practices that we've been sort of pushed to hopefully return to that. And hopefully we can take that lesson and then continue to iterate and co-create what it could be.
Mm-hmm. I love what you just did, Janelle. You took several big ideas that have been discussed and you just wove them together in a beautiful tapestry. Mariana, what would you like to offer?
I'm going to say that's the art of a teacher right there. Beautiful job. I'm just thinking about when my wellness was most compromised is when I wasn't in alignment within a school community that had the same values as me. And so similarly to what Janelle said, I think spending some time thinking about our motivation, our individual motivation for the work that we do, what our principles are, and what types of a connection we want to have with young people, what types of conversation and learning experiences we want to have with young people based on our values is really important. And then that might mean that we can't be a part of the school community that we're a part of. That's drastic. But it also might mean that, you know, teachers are often the most steady population within a school, or paras. I want to also, paras and their wellness are so often overlooked. But building with each other is incredibly important, in creating the kind of spaces you want, even if it's just with one other person or two other people, or even if it's just within your classroom, can be really powerful and really impact your individual wellness and shift the culture of the school. So,
I'm struck by, I think, two things, Ariana. One is that you're advising us, in order to work better, there's a type of work less. And then also that change throughout our school can come from us or us and one other colleague. And there's a lot of empowerment in what you're saying, because you're not telling me I've got to take over the whole system or I have to go rewrite the policy of my state capitol. And it feels doable the way that you put it.
Thank you all for this conversation. What I think you all have said, and I hope our audience really hears, is that schools should be joyful spaces where we're exploring, trying new things, making, creating, playing, being whole humans. And that ask is not complicated, as you all have named, in terms of the demands, but it is complicated because you can't measure it in the ways we measure kids and how they do school now. There's no standardized assessment for well-being. But there is an urgency to not return to the way things were. As Ontario said, normalcy is rooted in systematic problems. We need to reimagine and demand something better for teachers and students. And understand that if this is not a foundational component of how we return to schools, we will have lost a fundamental component of teaching and learning, the human connection. We have to start asking how you're doing and carving out time for educators to feel empowered to take care of themselves so they can show up for our students. That's all the time we have for today's discussion, but hopefully it's not the end of the conversation. Resources from our panelists will be available online wherever you stream the podcast, as well as in the chat if you're part of our live audience. Thank you to our panelists, Professor Ontario Garcia, Oriana Edis, and Janelle Bentz, for your thoughts, experiences, and time, and for being such advocates for equitable teaching practices. Thank you also to the California-based Family and Student Engagement Organizations, associations representing educators and system leaders, research institutes, and civil rights and equity groups, as well as PACE, that were responsible for the development of the Reimagine and Rebuild policy brief that launched this series. And thank you so much to my co-host, Dr. Janet Carlson, and our planning team, Heidi Chang, Leslie Cook, Jeannie Meng, Suzanne Burrows, and Glenn Kleinman. We are not here next week, but return Tuesday, June 1st for the final installment of our conversation for our series, Normal Was Never Good Enough, Resisting the Return to What Was, where we will discuss Learning Leads, Technology Serves, Promoting Student Agency, Authority, and Identity. I hope you can join us. In the meantime, be safe, be kind, and be well.